Oh, the shape that will get. If you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
Now, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Enda Call, and I'll be with you now until about 10 o'clock this evening. Coming up on tonight's show, I'll be bringing you some more of that chat with Stewie Byrne from last week as we delve into his Shelburne career and the tumultuous times of Ollie Byrne's reign at the club. But first, though, I want to talk about football rivalries. Colin Buig and Kieran Bradley join me in studio as we discuss some of our favourite football rivalries from England and across the world. Colin, me and you were chatting about Liverpool United before last week and how bad of a derby it's become in the last couple of years. Last weekend's game, it was a pretty good game.
Yeah, well, it depends. It depends who you're talking to. Well, I mean, do you mean good in terms of entertaining or
quality of the game,
fans?
A little bit of bite to it in the end. The players look to be getting into it. Fans were up for it as well. Anfield was rocking.
Yeah, it was. Andy Minton wrote a piece actually for The Athletic. He was talking about how what it was like being in the away end as a United fan, and how generally speaking it's much safer these days between Liverpool and Manchester and the United and Liverpool fans. But you could hear it through, like watching on TV, you could definitely hear the atmosphere, but it was just so much to do with the football itself, like, and United somehow stayed in the game and really did not play well. And yet Liverpool won the match. Like, as a Manchester United fan, I thought it was actually quite depressing to watch the game. But it's my favourite fixture of the season, definitely, Liverpool away, Anfield. I love it because I just love winning that fixture. But I mean, I'm even at a place, like, this is probably beside the point, but I'm even at a place as a United fan there where, like, is the best thing to do to win, to continue this regime? So I wasn't exactly happy to see Liverpool win.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole.
But it was, you know, it's still my favourite game. And sure, Jamie Carragher there was gloating about the viewership figures on it. It was like 3.4 million they had.
It wasn't really that impressive.
Yeah, good when you compare it to... I think Gary Lineker co-tweeted him back and said the Spurs Middlesbrough FA Cup third round replay got 500,000 more than that. But that you're talking about Trestio TV versus, you're packaged.
It makes a huge difference. The one thing I noticed from this game is, in particular was, if you look at the bickering on Sky Sports afterwards, it was sort of split down the middle with Souness and Carragher, with Evra and Keane on one end. And it was basically two sets of United players, two sets of Liverpool players just absolutely going at each other. And you could tell that there was a little bit of bitterness between their relationship.
Yeah, like I think that exchange proved more than any other thing that I've seen how the roles have switched from the traditional, you know, brickbats that would have been thrown at Liverpool fans for living in the past and the like. But the fact that Keane was going to the extent that he was to protect Solskjaer kind of shows that there's a little bit of a siege mentality even among people that wouldn't necessarily be predicted to do so. So, you know, like, there's always a bit of theatre to it. Roy Keane's absolutely perfectly suited to that role, a little bit of a devil's advocate. But as, you know, Joe's been saying on the show the last couple of days, like, his mind kind of speeds up as the anger kind of courses through him, as I'm sure the lads in Furness remember from our show. But, yeah, it's a sad state of affairs, really, at the moment.
Outside of that, basing it plainly on rivalries, because that's what we're here to talk about, before we go into the rabbit hole talking about where United are at the minute, Roy Keane, as a player, the rivalry would have been Arsenal. So where does the Liverpool-United match compare with the Arsenal-United games of the 2003-04 era?
You know, well, like, those Arsenal-United games were because of the quality of the teams. You know, that wasn't so much like the club, Arsenal versus the club, Manchester United, whereas United-Liverpool transcends any form or talent in the squad, i.e. the game just gone from a United perspective. But like those United Arsenal games are just nostalgic for United fans now because they were so competitive, and you didn't just have the competitiveness, but you had the quality as well, like scattered throughout the pitch. So much so when Keane and Vieira shot that Best of Enemies documentary a few years ago, and they had to pick their combined 11, between the two sides. It was genuinely really interesting to watch, to see who they'd pick, and more importantly, who they'd omit from their team. Mm. But now, United Liverpool have transcended who plays. It's just the intense rivalry of it, and that's the difference for me. That's always been the difference.
Yeah, I suppose that brings us on to a little bit more of an interesting point, that there are games that are rivalries because of the quality opposition.
Yeah.
And there's games that are rivalries because there's a deep-seated animosity between the two sets of fans. For example, we'll use another United example, the United-Leeds rivalry of the 90s. That was based on the fact that Leeds were very, very close opponents at United. It has nothing to do with where the cities are.
Well, I disagree slightly. I think there is a bit of a Trans-Pennine rivalry. It's funny because if you were to look at a map of the UK at times, you're kind of like, well, why are they rivals? Particularly if, I'm sure we'll get onto Palace and Brighton later in the show. But that one was just, there's kind of the whole Lancashire-Yorkshire thing is on top of the teams being as close as they were. And the absolute cauldron that Elland Road used to be in those matches. Like, they were consistently my favourite matches. Like, when I was growing up, like, particularly around sort of that period where Leeds had the team of, you know, Kewell and Viduka and Smith, and like around 0102, like, it was just insane. And it's funny how those things actually develop, because we were talking about Liverpool and United earlier. I was reading the Busby book recently, and obviously the links that he had with Liverpool, that has sort of developed relatively late on, like, in terms of the total antipathy. Like, you can't imagine ever a player from United going to Liverpool now, or vice versa, whereas we're in a slightly different state of affairs with Leeds where they are at the moment. But that's why most Manchester United fans want the backup, and Leeds probably too.
You'd be more familiar with the county element of England, so talk to us a little bit about that. Like, where does that come from? What counties would be a little bit more at each other's necks than the others?
Yeah, well, I mean, Yorkshire and Lancashire and Greater Manchester, I suppose, would kind of goes back to War of the Roses and all that kind of caper. But the reality is that most of it comes from economic, you know, rivalries. So even if you're looking at Liverpool versus United, it's apparently based on the proximity to the Manchester Canal. So basically, it bypassed Liverpool. So all the exports were actually coming into Manchester, and they built up a cotton trade and a very booming kind of textile trade. So that's where the actual rivalries between the cities happened. And then I suspect that the ones in London, i.e. Arsenal Spurs, or even Arsenal Chelsea, Spurs Chelsea, etc., they're just strict proximity, and, you know, it's you're pretty much all on top of each other too. So
yeah, well,
and the other ones are fairly, the other rivalries, like the sort of Watford Luton or something like that, they're always, strike me as fairly kind of peripheral ones, but not to the fans, I'm sure.
The London ones are very much derbies because they're in the same city. Out of the London derbies, which are the best? Because I'm going to throw my hat in here, and I think that Arsenal Tottenham for years now has been a brilliant game. The fans have been at each other, the players have been at each other. If you recall Dele Alli's goal a few years back, where he slid in front of the Arsenal fans, and you see the still image, and it looks like something from the Renaissance.
Yeah.
For me, that's the best London derby. I'm not sure if you disagree.
You're very much a Renaissance man, though, Enda.
Oh God, yeah, I am.
Just see what he's wearing now, like, Jesus, amazing. Definitely Spurs Arsenal. You were saying before we started recording, Chelsea-Arsenal was your favourite, was it? That you had like that buzz?
I think Arsenal-Chelsea is always a brilliant game. And there's just something about watching the red and blue.
Mm.
It's
colours.
Yeah, it's deep-seated in like English culture, this red against blue.
Yeah.
And that, for me, like, I think it's always a very open game of football. It's always entertaining. Yeah. But when it comes to like modern derbies in England aren't really comparable with modern derbies from Europe and from South America and even from up in Scotland, because there's not, no, it's not as intense.
It depends.
But
yeah,
Arsenal Tottenham always strikes me as one that's kind of kept that little bite about it.
Yeah, Arsenal Tottenham have, I guess, a mixture of what we were saying earlier about Arsenal Tottenham is always a really good game, especially the last, say, just round figure of 5 years. But I would say that's a pretty comfortable estimate, right? Yeah. United Arsenal had that quality of rivalry, and then United Liverpool has the history, and Arsenal Spurs is a bit of both. But obviously, as a United fan, you'd be looking towards the other one. But like, Arsenal Spurs is a game, as a United fan, where they would be traditionally two huge rivalries, or certainly modern terms with Spurs, that I still really enjoy watching that game, regardless of how it would impact on United. I think it's a really brilliant game of football, and you can actually hear through the TV you can hear the crowd. You can really hear it, because sometimes you think you're like, I would say the vast majority of Premier League games that I watch, you really can't hear much from the crowd. That's not a generalisation, because actually when you're at these matches, you're like, there's actually a lot more said than you would think watching TV. Like, yeah, a lot more. It's like the bitty comments and like how fans rate certain players that you were never going to hear through TV. But with that game, that's a testament for me about the quality, or that's the litmus test for a good rivalry or a good derby, is that you can hear it through your TV. And your volume could be at a moderate level, and you can still hear.
Best thing ever when a commentator has to apologise on behalf of the language. Yeah.
They generally have to do that at Burnley, because the Burnley press box is right beside the fans. There's no protection at all. Yeah. So.
No, like, I agree. Arsenal Chelsea, I think, particularly going back to even the start of the 2000s, sort of 2000, 2001, etc., was such a beguiling one, because it was also at that stage. They were the two teams that were packed with foreign stars as well. So it really felt like the kind of coming of age of like Premier League football when I was growing up. I think maybe it's been lost a little bit over the last few years. But another one I'd throw into the mix for London is West Ham against Spurs. That one is massive, particularly for West Ham. I think West Ham fans are always looking to those fixtures throughout when the fixtures are announced. And Spurs too. Spurs love putting it over on them. Like, I've got mates who are season ticket holders in both, and they absolutely love that. And they really like are extremely nervous on the day. So.
Yeah. Well, what amazes me about London is that it's a footballing city. Like, it's absolutely engulfed in football, but you wouldn't notice that at all. If you have your Arsenals, Chelsea, Fulham, Crystal Palace, yeah, to an extent. It's greater London more than anything, but yeah, you wouldn't actually notice that if you're in London city centre.
It's a weird one, because I think that fans of those teams have been forced to coexist, right? So if you walk down Seven Sisters Road in an Arsenal shirt, like on a non-match day, you're probably not really going to get much grief. In the same way that if you're walking through Islington with Spurs, you're probably not going to get much. However, the shoe was on the other foot. Any time of the year, if you walk through Leeds City Centre wearing my United kit, or walk through Liverpool City Centre with the United kit on, you would get absolute brickbats from people. And look, it's not going to turn ugly or anything, but it's just people making comments and stuff like that. And I think that really that speaks to the visceral nature of the rivalries further north. But it is interesting, yeah, the London one, you can kind of, it'd pass you by a little bit.
Well, Damien Delaney said the one of the reasons he loved playing for Crystal Palace and living in London, and it kind of brings into a broader point of why players want to live in London, is that he was able to live a normal life without people wondering and coming up asking for pictures. He could, for example, he could get the tube home after a game, and he would be completely fine.
Yeah,
that's interesting to me that these rivalries in England don't have much of a cultural impact, especially in non-match days, which is particularly interesting to hear, because you look at, like, say, in Belgrade, Red Star versus Partizan. That's like Red Star is like the team of the people. Mm. Partizan are like state-backed, so there's always that rivalry, and they're only separated by like 400 metres the stadium, so there's a park that separates them, and the fans fight there. And then you have even Ajax and Feyenoord. Ajax are seen as the liberal side. Feyenoord are a bit more industrial and right-wing. So it always fascinates me that there are, like, Galatasaray and Fenerbahce, the same middle class versus working class, and it's a cultural thing, and they meet on the football pitch to have this rivalry out, where, I don't know, I feel that in England it's not a class system
football. It's almost, if you think about it, like, the class system is the actual sport itself. The sport is the one that was played and watched by working classes, whereas rugby, or even maybe cricket to a lesser extent, is the kind of one of the more landed gentry, etc. Like the ones going back to United Liverpool particularly, like there was I was listening to Andy Minton's podcast a little while back, where they were talking about one of the stewards at Old Trafford actually is the guy who got the famous photo of the guy with the dart in the face when he was at Anfield, and it's a very iconic photo of sort of peak hooliganism and that kind of thing. But they were speaking to him about, you know, what do you feel the rivalries are now? It's absolutely nothing like what it used to be in the past. So maybe we've kind of got to a point where the class system's been sort of overtaken by a little bit of feeling of kind of cleanliness, I suppose, with the entire situation.
Well, that comes with the Premier League as well. The fact
there's
so many fans at these games that are tourists for a day or weekend trip, and that's absolutely fine. A lot of people want to come and watch the team that they've supported from outside of the country, and that's completely fair. That's what Irish people do when they go over, their tourists as well. But back maybe just before the Premier League, or even in the early days, it was very much English people at English football matches supporting their team, and that's probably where the likes of the hardcore supporters came from. And because there's less and less of those going to the games, the technical allocations, they're all behind the goals, that maybe that's why it's kind of settled down a little bit.
Has to be. Because, like, I was hearing Liverpool, like, the hardcore Liverpool supporters at Anfield have no respect for Liverpool jerseys, like official replica jerseys. They see them, they're either tourists or children wear them, and that's it. So they don't, you're not going to see them, they're not going to stand out as Liverpool fans, but they actually are the biggest Liverpool fans. And for me, it was interesting, like Kieran was saying there about West Ham Spurs. Like, I wonder, and this is a question and not a point, but a question, is that with each team moving into this new fancy modernised stadium, does that impact the rivalry? Does that attract more tourists to the games, to the Olympic Stadium, to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium? Or will there always be that hardcore support, but they're either littered throughout the stadium, or they watch it from a different location?
Yeah, I think the new stadium's probably copper fastened what's there pretty much already. As in, I don't think that they, like, say Everton moving from Goodison to Bramley Park is going to just completely change the fan base. I think that's probably happened gradually over the course of a period of time anyway. I think, look, we've just kind of moved into a new era, and it's probably a new era that we're all pretty happy with, because we don't really want to go to games where you're getting a dart in the fucking eye or whatever. So it's really important that you're able to be able to take children and actually kind of make that generational, you know, these are our rivals, but also, you know, you don't have to be shouting abuse, screaming abuse at individual, or singing about horrible events.
This is the compromise that the world of football has made in the last 15 years, is that, or even, we'll say 20 years, is that the football now is just objectively better than it was 20 years ago. Like, I always use the example, or I have done for the last year anyway, is I watched back the Champions League final from 99, the famous Solskjaer game for the treble. And this is Manchester United and Bayern Munich, the two best teams in Europe at the time. And when you compare the style of football in that game and the standard of football to a modern-day Premier League, I'd say mid-table-up Premier League game, the technique, like, there was only a couple of players on each side that night from Bayern and from Man United who could, like, you could put them into a modern day game and they'd fit in quite well. Like, David Beckham had a great game that night, but I remember there were so many others. There was just pot shots from a distance that were so amateur looking in comparison. But I suppose back then there was more tribalism, maybe it was a bit more exciting, there was more to it, and it was more accessible for people. And now it's become an unstoppable product.
Well, that accessibility is a massive thing, because if you look at the ticket prices for a club like Arsenal, they're massive. They're way above the line of affordability for most people who would be previous fans of Arsenal. And even if you look at the rest of the ticket prices in the Premier League, completely, vastly engulfs what you pay for in the likes of Germany.
It's insane.
Germany has kept that fan culture that England seems to have lost.
Yeah, Borussia Dortmund is the club, isn't it, that everyone aspires to be in that sense, with the relatively affordable.
They have the 50 plus one or whatever it is, that, like, ownership model. I'm not sure how far across that goes in the Bundesliga in terms of fan ownership, so that probably certainly helps. But just on the point of ticketing, also the timing of these games as well, like, they've been moved endlessly for foreign audiences, which is a nature of the sport as we are, but it's probably impacted on the rivalries themselves.
Well, that and the fact that, without putting all of the blame on the British government, they have stamped out any tiny detail that could lead to hooliganism in football. They have done their best to stamp that out. For example, in Scotland, the Old Firm game can never be played later than 12 o'clock, because if you leave it longer than 12 o'clock, the idea at least is that fans will go to the pub and get absolutely messed up, and then that'll cause. But for me, the idea of that is completely classist. That football fans, if you leave them off their own means, that they'll do damage.
But why did Liverpool United kick off at 4:30 on Sunday? That's the latest kickoff I can ever remember of a weekend tie between those two clubs.
I actually had to double check it, because we were doing the commentary in here, and I was like, that can't be on that late.
4:30. Presumably that was Sky Sports thinking this is going to be our best chance of figures, and they were correct. But if that's one, that's probably the most, what you would say, aggressive rivalry in English football.
Yeah.
To be fair. And that was
off the big teams.
A genuine rivalry that still exists to this day.
Of the teams that meet regularly, because like a Millwall West Ham or something like that would be.
There was a study done recently. I'm not sure how scientific this is at all. I just looked it up. and they did a ranking of the 30 biggest rivalries in England based on how much the fans dislike each other. So I'm not sure how they did this, but Arsenal-Tottenham is third on that list. Manchester United versus Liverpool is fourth, coming behind Exeter-Plymouth-Argyle.
All right.
Never been to that game, never seen that game, nice. But apparently they hate each other. And Portsmouth-Southampton.
Oh, yeah, that's a yeah, big...
Is number one, it's number one on that list.
Portsmouth manager the second time around. You know, but proximity doesn't necessarily mean huge rivalry, because isn't this Nottingham Forest and Notts County... have quite a decent relationship, and didn't Forest help out Notts County when they were in financial trouble and nearly ruined a couple of years ago? Whereas Forest and Derby hate each other.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So its proximity is not necessarily the reason.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, Forest Derby is the one, I presume it had predated Clough anyway, but obviously Clough come in and moving between the clubs, but yeah, again, like the proximity, it's still pretty close. It's only sort of half hour down the road, and they would play each other regularly enough. In a way, like, familiarity breeds contempt. Like, if you play someone regularly enough, even Liverpool Chelsea is a perfect example. I was living in Liverpool when that started kicking off. I moved there in 2004.
Yeah,
and then you saw it develop, and I always felt it was a little bit pallid. Like, it wasn't really, you know, it was just
because they played each other all the time.
They were playing each other every 2 weeks.
It's like Ireland Denmark is the international rivalry.
International
derby.
Well, if you look at like some of the proximity clubs, you're looking at Aston Villa and Birmingham. Mm. They're sharing a city. Newcastle Sunderland just split up by a river. Essentially, that's how you decide who you're supporting.
Yeah,
and that for me is a massive rivalry, Sunderland Newcastle.
Yeah, it is. So it's funny because I think Newcastle Sunderland, and to an extent, in a different way, someone like Portsmouth Southampton strike me as quite similar. Insofar as while they're quite big cities, they are quite poor cities as well. So like a lot of the time, rivalries come from fan culture, and I'm certainly not making a point about class per se, but a lot of young men look forward to these games as like an outlet of sort. And like we've all been at matches where you look around, you're like, what the hell's wrong with you, mate? Like just relax, whatever, just, you know, chucking stuff or going crazy. And I think Newcastle Sunderland's one of those ones where it's just like, it's chaos. Like you're always guaranteed a red card. The action on the pitch is mirrored by what's in the stands, and I really enjoy Newcastle Sunderland.
It's funny that players and then kind of casual fans are so accepting of the viciousness of certain rivalries and like the importance of them without really questioning it. Like you often hear of players coming to the Premier League for the first time and playing for, say, we'll keep it North London and say our Spurs. And the week or the couple of weeks prior to that derby, they're reminded constantly by the long-term players there that whatever you do, you have to win this game. You have to beat Spurs and or Arsenal, whoever you're on, whichever side you're on. And I think even Ian Wright was talking about that when he joined Arsenal from Crystal Palace in the 90s. And he said like all that he heard when he first joined was from the likes of Tony Adams and Lee Dixon and Nigel Winterburn, Paul Merson, that whatever you do, like you could score 30 goals a season here. But if you don't do it against Spurs, there's always going to be a question mark over you. And Ian Wright just accepted that, and he would be one of the more outspoken characters. And it's funny that it's a human nature thing where there's no one steps back and thinks, why do we hate each other so much here? And everyone just goes along with it. And that's exactly the same for fans. So there's immediately a different atmosphere in the stadium when you're at these games. And it's one of the few games a season where it doesn't really matter about the quality of play so much, you just have to win the match.
Yeah, it's just...
And it's the casual viewer then who's affected by it. You're like, oh, the game's so great. But then it's the other, you do enjoy the hostility. You still enjoy, because it is theatre at the end of the day. Like, it's just entertainment. But I just find it really interesting that once upon a time, this massive rivalry was created, and now that's the way it is. And if that rivalry dissipates in any way, that's a bad thing to happen. It's funny, that's funny to me.
Yeah.
Outside of England, what's our favourite rivalries?
Well, if you want to stay in the UK, it's still Celtic Rangers. That's just pure emotion. And
let's strip everything away. You've engineered this entire podcast so that we can talk about this. So
have you been to an Old Firm?
Never been to an Old Firm.
No.
It's one of the things that I really want to get to.
Yeah.
In the past, it was probably easier to do it. I probably missed my chance to do it when it was probably at its least... angry. And
when was it at least angry?
Probably about 3 years ago, when Rangers were still very much in the ether, very much in the mirrors of Celtic in the second division, and they were coming up, and Celtic fans just had no respect for for Rangers at that point. But it's amazing to me that that rivalry has survived this long and still kept its anger and hostility.
But that's what I mean. Like, no one questions it. They just go along with it. But like, that's nothing to do. Like, that game has nothing to do with football. Out of all these rivalries,
not anymore. Yeah.
I absolutely love the Old Firm games and I love the idea of the Old Firm and all this kind of game. But I think we have to be really careful of inheriting other people's beefs. I think that's actually a big problem in fan culture in general. Like when you're talking about United, Liverpool, and throwing slurs at people. I just think it's really, really kind of tame. But sorry, just on the, like, I watched the first Old Firm I've seen in ages just over Christmas, and my God, the rivalry is back and is banging now because it was 2-1.
It's massive for Scottish football, and it's very important for Scottish football that this stays as strong as it is, because it brings in the casual viewers, and casual viewers bring in money. But on the inheriting other people's beef, there was a piece done with a fan, Rangers fan, who moved to Scotland, moved to Glasgow, and he was from, I think it was India or Pakistan, and he got involved in it, and he's now banned from Old Firm games because he got so... he was going so far with his chants that he was getting kicked out. And he didn't know what the chants meant, like the history of the chants. He obviously knew what they meant, but he saw it as football banter. He didn't see it as sectarian chants. He was singing the Billy Boys. He was singing songs about Fenians, all this here, aiming them towards Celtic fans. And he just saw it as banter.
Yeah, but he just wanted to assimilate. That's all. He just wanted to assimilate.
He just wanted to be part of.
He just wanted to be part of something. Yeah, nothing to do with football. Like I, you were saying, it's good for Scottish football, Celtic Rangers, but it just exists in its own island for me. That rivalry, it's just its own thing. Like it happens to be in the Scottish Premiership.
Yeah, it's the closest thing to, say, the River Plate Boca rivalry.
Yeah. They'll say that's much more extreme. Like if you ever hear Maradona talk about it, but. There was a video online a few months ago of a fan who didn't support either Celtic or Rangers, but he went to both Ibrox and Parkhead to do a tour wearing the other team's jersey.
I thought that was idiotic.
Go on, why?
You're stoking something there. He was looking for...
He's wearing a shirt. Like.
He was going out looking for...
But he wanted to see what the reaction would be.
He did, but we mentioned about wearing a shirt in different parts of the city. As a Celtic fan growing up, when we were going to Celtic matches from Donegal, we had to go through the north to get to the ferry, and we were advised not to wear any Celtic gear going through the north in case it stoked up anger. Like, if you're doing that, you're looking for a reaction. You're looking to stoke up that anger. And for me, that was an idiotic thing to do. It's further adding to that anger and animosity towards the fans.
Do you think that anger just from... basically a piece of clothing that someone's wearing is stupid, would you say?
I think it's idiotic.
Yeah.
But you have to be aware that exists.
It exists, yeah.
That attitude.
Do you agree with it, though?
I don't agree with the attitude.
What's your opinion? What if you saw someone wearing a Rangers jersey? What are your first thoughts? You don't care?
It's a shirt. I wore a Northern Ireland t-shirt in here. Ireland were playing Northern Ireland in a friendly, and because people make jokes about my accents... I decided I'd wear a Northern Ireland jersey and to see what reaction I got, and people were unhappy. It's a piece of cloth with a crest on it.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a former Republic of Ireland midfielder who had a
he was not happy with it. And I know that sometimes sometimes those jerseys can represent something else to other people, and that's fair enough. That's their view. But I think that you should be able to wear whatever you want
But we are going that way in society. I think the younger generation. It's definitely they're becoming much less partisan in that way, and it's more a more connected world. Like, this is a much bigger conversation, but basically the world is much more, or is the most connected it's been, and therefore they're seen as frivolous now. Which I suppose, if you describe that rivalry as frivolous, then you are definitely antagonising the people who care about it. I'm not saying that either.
I don't blame the person who told you to not wear Celtic tops. I completely understand that. Like, but. What it comes down to for me is personal responsibility, because if there's a difference between you driving through an estate that might be anti-Celtic in some respect and flicking the V's at everyone going around with your Celtic tops and doing that. However, if you're literally just wearing a shirt, the responsibility is completely on the other individual to keep themselves in the decent society that we tend to live
in. I agree, but what I'm trying to get a point across is that he's going through Republican areas of Glasgow wearing a Rangers top. he's going through loyalist areas of Glasgow wearing a Celtic top, knowing full well that that's going to cause an uproar if he walks amongst the wrong set of fans. And yes, I agree with what you're saying, that the onus is not on him for being attacked, it's on the attackers
attacking him.
But if, but if he were to be had things thrown at him or even jumped or anything, the worst of the worst could have happened. He's putting a black mark on that, on one set of fans, when really he should have had more sense than to walk down.
Yeah, like, I agree with that. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't think anyone really enjoys this, particularly when it's done for, you know, social media clicks and views and stuff like that. I don't really feel that's useful. But, and the weird thing would have been had he just decided to keep going until something happened, because he had an end goal in mind. Yeah, well,
Chris. Like, Andy Gorham was at Manchester United for 2 months in 2001. And himself and Roy Keane didn't speak a word, because Corham's a Rangers legend and Roy's a massive Celtic fan. And I heard Roy speak a few years ago, and he was asked the day he left Man United, and he said, like, you know, he cried in the car the day he left Man United. And as he was driving away, you know, he was thinking, what am I going to do next? And in hindsight, he was saying, like, he should have just packed it in then, because he said, the only reason I signed for Celtic was because I fancied a game against Rangers.
Yeah, well, that's it. Like, you want to play in the biggest games, and we have a couple of big ones coming up in the next few weeks.
Go on.
We have Chelsea Arsenal, that's tonight as we're recording it.
Yeah.
Tottenham Man City, 1st of February, and Chelsea versus Man United on the 17th of February after the winter break.
Hopefully there's going to be another scrub out there. That's not a rivalry. That's insane.
Did you say Tottenham City?
Tottenham City.
They're just competing.
Yeah, they're competitors more than
that's fair enough. Just this.
But at the bay, we're not specifically talking about derbies, it's just rivalries.
So before we wrap this up, then, we're all in agreement that Celtic Rangers is the best.
Absolutely, unequivocally so. And I'm actually not even joking. It's amazing.
I know that. I mean, when I was thinking, when you mentioned this segment to me or this show, that's the first thing that came into my mind was Celtic Rangers. But then, like, the most enjoyable rivalry for me is Barcelona Real Madrid. But that's always to do with football, and the game for me was like November 2010 when Barcelona beat Real Madrid 5-0 when Mourinho was Madrid manager. That was one of the most complete performances I've ever seen anywhere, and so that for me is a great rivalry. But like Celtic Rangers is just vitriolic, and it kind of exists in its own island, I think, in every way these days, because I don't think there's rivalries like that.
Yeah. All right, Colin Buick, Kieran Bradley, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll take a quick break.
It felt like watching The Invincibles again. You know, it felt like I was on the North Bank and watching Pires and Lundberg and everything, you know, shouting, "We love you, Freddie," and stuff. It's just like that.
Still a bird cap. And Lundberg! Arsenal in the lead. And Jason Yeo gave the ball away for Charlton. And you can't do that against this team. They'll punish you.
Henry goal the other day, the back heel, just showed it, you know, he's the master, isn't he, really?
Henry in the near post position here.
This for 3 points, this to beat fierce rivals, this to go top of the Premiership tonight. The responsibility rests with Ruud van Nistelrooy.
Not only the team, but the club is strong, you know, when the club is facing adversity, the door is bound to his back.
Bergkamp.
Making history is something that unfolds. It's not something you ever know. It's something, you know, such is the standard now that, you know, Manchester United had been the sort of, they'd been the benchmark, and we were wrestling that away. We almost had to go clear around, which is what we ended up with, to win it. You know, there's such was the standards that they were winning every week, we had to win every week.
Now we're turning to our interview with Stewie Byrne. He was in with me last week ahead of his gig in the Workman's Club. That was all part of Shelburne's 125th celebrations. And we got speaking about his own career at the club. How do you reflect on your Shelburne career?
Very proud, I have to say. Personally very proud. They're the best days of my life, best of not just my footballing career, probably the best days of my life. They were fantastic. They were tough, hard, and probably wouldn't have had it any other way, but there were great days. But proud also because I feel anyway that we certainly took football on a level from where it had been. I think the important thing about that is that, you know, when you set standards for others, others take it on board, and then they set standards for others. And so I do feel proud to be part of that, and to have brought the standard of football up, despite all the adversities and the difficulties that the football community, the soccer community, finds in this country. There's a lot of negatives out there, but there's an awful lot of positives. And the European stuff was specifically important because I feel that subsequently also led to that improvement in Europe that Shamrock Rovers went and did in back in 2011, 2012. Then you had the likes of Dundalk and taking it on a step further. And I think that's really important. So once, you know, when I look back, I'm very proud to have played for the football club. I have a very, very soft spot for the football club, like, because it looked after me. I felt I gave it back, you know, whatever it gave me, I gave back. And I don't know, there's just something about the place. Something about the place is quite magical. Like, you know, fantastic, magical nights there, you know.
I want to focus probably on three different parts of your Shells career. Firstly, we'll start with, as you mentioned, the European run in 2004. Myself and yourself did a documentary on this on Off the Ball a few months ago. Is that probably one of the best European runs that an Irish team is likely to go on?
I'd be biased. I'd say it's definitely, if you know, it's definitely up there with anything that has probably come before. See, everything is relative. Like, you know, you have to look at it relative to the time, relative to what had happened even before. Not much had happened really. Like, you know.
Well, if you compare, say, to the likes of Dundalk's run a few years ago, when they come up and give a good fight against Zenit. People were astounded that an Irish club were able to put it up against a club like Zenit. But you just put it up to a Deportivo team that were almost fighting for the Champions League the year before that.
I think that's what people forget, yeah. I think, and I hate to be the one to kind of, you know, you have to kind of remind people of exactly what we were up against. But yeah, you said it, like, you know, effectively, that Deportivo team had gotten to the semi-final of the competition. And were knocked out of the semi-final by the winners, Porto, Jose Mourinho's Porto. Yeah. So when we drew them, we were, we were excited, yeah, but we were shocked, couldn't believe we were getting this team at this stage of the competition, you know. And so we very quickly had to prepare for the game and basically come up with, a game plan to try and beat them. You know, with a little bit of luck in the first game, it could have gone a different way. I think we could have won. We should have won the first game at least 1-0. We probably should have gone over there with a goal. And then you're over there and you're going head to toe with them, like, you know, and it's nil all at halftime over there. And all of a sudden, you're trying to think of, you're sort of readjusting your game plan because you've gotten through the first leg, you've gotten halfway through the second leg, and you know you're now tactically saying, okay. You know, we need to sort of maybe adjust things to try and get a goal here, and maybe, you know, give yourself every opportunity to go through. And unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. Look, I think their quality told in the end, you know, and maybe a little bit of naivety and inexperience at that level and at that stage of a competition told with us. and subsequently we got outdone. But we, you know, we were very proud of it, and like so much so, we were after the game, we were disgusted. We were genuinely deflated by it. We didn't come out the pitch saying, you know, look, we've been beaten by one of the top teams in Europe here. We were really, really, really devastated that we didn't push them a little bit closer. Like, you know, I think that probably tells you where our headspace was.
Well, if you watch back the post-match interviews from Owen Heary at the time, it tells a tale of where your mindset was, that you actually felt like you could have gone on further in the competition and made it to the group stages.
That's how we were thinking. That's really, and especially at half-time, that's how we were thinking, you know. We were devastated, absolutely devastated, and it was probably good that Owen that went out and gave the interview, because he was able to sort of articulate that for the group. Yeah. But we were really, really gutted, you know.
Do you think that this run by Shelburne in 2004, do you think that it acts as sort of a, not a starting block as such, but sort of a beginning of Irish sides having a bit of a say in Europe and being respected by other European leagues as potential candidates for group stages, at least?
It became a belief thing. So I think you know, and I felt this personally as a player when I was, you know, 18, 19, and I was signed with Bowes as a kid, and I played in Europe with Bowes as an 18-year-old, and I just felt that we were going out to be beaten. We were of that semi-professional mindset. It was a trip away to Minsk. It was a bit of crack, you know, but I just didn't think that we gave ourselves any opportunity. So there was a real lack of belief among League of Ireland clubs that they could really pit it with the best. And there was two things wrong there, you know, tactically and conditioning wise, we weren't at the same level, you know, especially tactically and technically, that kind of, you know, those tactically, technically and physical condition. There are three real things that were probably, but probably the most important thing was that belief and confidence. You know, we were never confident enough to go up against the best. So I think when we did what we did, I think that changed the mindset and said, hang on a second, we can do this. Like, you know, in fairness, we'd gone full time. So I think we were starting to tick the technical box and the tactical box, and the physical conditioning was there because we were fitter. But ultimately, more than anything, that belief that you know, at the end of the day, it's 11v11. It's me against another guy. It's him against another guy. And it's just, I think you when you play in Europe, you develop a bigger understanding for the tactical side of the game, you know. Very much the domestic game was torn up 4-4-2, just go and play.
Yeah.
But what had happened at that period was the game was becoming much more technical. Coaches were becoming brought up to speed on different formations. You'd start to do video evidence on opponents, and you were really starting to dive deep into the different sort of elements of the game, and we had done that in preparation for that run, and you could really see that you know, we had prepared right and we had a better understanding of our opponents and how they played and what we can do to kind of to counteract that and maybe go get a goal. So all those things, I think, sort of led to sort of an improved performance in Europe, and ultimately led to, you know, better, you know, performance by other clubs as well.
Yeah, I think you can sort of see that in the likes of Dundalk's run under Stephen Kenny, that they were built physical, they were big physical players that were far fitter than anyone else in the League of Ireland. They've finished a video evidence room now in Dundalk. They have a new fitness centre, so you're kind of seeing this evolution again further on from where you were back then. But I want to move on to 2006 and the aforementioned Stephen Kenny, because he plays a big role in this season.
I'll never live this down.
And particularly at the end of the season.
Yeah.
That famous interview with you telling Tony that you're angry.
Yeah.
How do you reflect on that?
Well, I was angry.
Are you still angry?
I'm not still angry now. No. I'm older and wiser now. I was fuming at the time. An awful lot had gone on in the club that year, that week even.
And, just for a bit of background, what happened was Dublin City had gone bust that year.
Oh, loads has gone wrong.
Shelburne had beaten them twice.
Yeah.
6 points. Derry City under Stephen Kenny had only beaten them once.
And gotten beaten by them.
Yeah. So they had 3 points. So there's a bit of a mix up on who's on what points. But eventually it boils down to the last game of the season.
Yeah, yeah. We had points taken off us and then we lost 6 points. But effectively, Derry gained 6 points, you know, through an admin alteration. And yeah, exactly. And it was that, and it was the financial stuff had been going on in the club. On a personal level, myself and Owen Heary and Ollie Call, Dave Rogers, we had been sort of meeting with the club in the background over, and I think we knew it was gone, like, you know. So and there was also the frustration of the previous year where we should have walked that league. We didn't turn up that league like that year, and so there was all this sort of, you know, there was all this frustration, and there was a lot going on. And I think in me personally, it just kind of, it all came out that night. Like, you know, I'd won man of the match. That's the reason why I was interviewed. Yeah. So I think it just came out. That was it. I couldn't keep it in. I had to come out. I felt I had to kind of defend the club. Like, and you know, I think the club, my time with the club, you know, as much as it's great to talk about it now, and we look back at the great things that we achieved, and that is great, and that's the most important thing. But at the time, there was a lot of negative stuff towards Shells, like that we paid the most money, we bought players. Ollie Bourne was always griping, and you know, getting favors done his way, and it just wasn't true, like, you know, and just felt on the night I had to kind of defend the club, and that's what came out. I mean, I look back and I don't think you have enough of that in football anymore. It's all very much, yeah, yeah, blah, 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 you know, this is great, that's great, everything's great. Like, you know, people don't sort of speak out enough and express their emotion enough, like, you know, so you kind of miss that.
Well, Ollie Bourne was actually going to be the third thing that I wanted to talk about, because he plays a big part in your Shell's career. Shelburne, they had a fantastic squad, but that squad obviously doesn't come from anywhere. It needs funding behind the scenes, and after the success comes a bit of a downfall, a dark period for the club.
I was awful, yeah. And it was immediate as well, because Ollie passed away probably within 6 months of that game. That game was in November. No, I think Ollie passed in the June of the next year. He had a tumor in his brain, and he took ill immediately, like, you know. And obviously, the stresses and strains of running the club took its toll on him, and the club was devastated by it. Like, you know, because he's a larger than life character, Ollie. Like, you know, Ollie was a real scrapper and fighter, and a clever, incredibly intelligent man. He was very well read up on the law, and used that to his advantage, especially when he had to go head to head with the FAI. Mm-hmm. And I would be of the opinion, I tell you this now, if he was still around, some of the stuff that's going on now would never have gone on. Like, you know, I think the league misses somebody like that, somebody that really fights for the game, you know, the football game, the rights of the clubs and the players. And he very much did that. Like, you know, he defended his own football club, but he was brilliant at sort of defending the club and the players, like, you know. And he was a great loss. Now, look, listen, Ollie did things arseways. He did. But it's kind of a strange relationship that football has with him. And when you look back, I look back with fondness. Now, I look back at some of the silly, stupid things that he did. But for a long time it worked, he got away with it. I think maybe there was a year or two where he just got completely ran away with himself, and maybe the illness was playing its toll there, I don't know. But if you ask any player that's come through the club and has left the club, none of them look back and talk negative about Ollie.
Yeah.
And that's him, you know. He looked after players, he bent over backwards for them, like, you know. And I suppose that's his legacy, really, isn't it? That the players think of him in a different way completely, you know?
Yeah, well, even when we were doing the documentary, yourself and Owen Heary were chatting away about various different things that you remember him doing. And if you look at it now, in today's light, it sounds outrageous. But I think, again, you have to put context in it that these were different times. It's almost 15, 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
And that kind of carry-on was just seen as being, you know, a part of his personality, a part of the larger life. And people didn't really take it as a serious thing.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose what it was like, in a lot of ways, he was ahead of his time. Like, you know, Ollie was the first, that brand new stand that was built behind the goal was state of the art at the time. He put a commercial box into it, mm-hmm. you know, it was way beyond anything anyone in the league had done. That, I mean, that was put in 2002, you know, and you know, we spoke about the lift. The lift was brilliant because it was 05-06. We hadn't been paid. And all of a sudden, there's this food lift going in to the stand that will bring food up to the commercial box. It costs about €50,000. Like, you know, we're going, and paid us. You know, it's all right. Like, and he'd be sort of trying to butter his way around, you know. It was just madness. But you could see what he was trying to do. And you got no help in them days. It was him trying to bring Shells to another level. You know, we had done it on the pitch and he was trying to kick it on again. And that's the reason why I signed for Shells, because from playing against Shelbourne, you know, Shells, they'd turn up and they'd be in the best of gear and they'd had the skips and the kit men would arrive 2 hours before the game. Like, you know, none of this stuff was, this is all unheard of. Like, this is back in the mid-late 90s, completely unheard of. And I'm just going, I want to play, that's the way I want to play for, like, you know. So, in a way, the reason the club was as successful as it was because he pushed the standards. The reason the club collapsed so badly is because he went too far.
Yeah, you know. Well, it was the sign of the times.
It was almost the
entire country. Yeah. People kind of ran away with themselves. Yeah. But eventually, over many, many years of rebuilding, Shells are finally back in Premier Division this year under Ian Morris. How do you think they're going to get on?
It'll be tough for them. You know, any step up from the First Division to the Premier Division is always it's a different style of football, and it can be difficult. But I think they're well placed to do. I think they've effectively the squad that they had in the First Division was in the majority made up of what I would say be good Premier Division players, you know. So they're making that step up, and they've signed brought a couple in. I think what's really positive this time around is that there's a good vibe behind the club again. Like, you know, the club are now out of debt. I'd like to say the memory of the bad years is starting to fade, which I think is really important, because I think you have to move on as a club at some stage. You can't continuously look back and say, you know, be negative about why did we do that, and, you know, and blame him and blame them for getting this and this. You know, that you have to move on from that. You can't progress if you're constantly stuck in the past, you know. So I think that's important for the football club. So, and they really are starting to find their identity back again. I think there's this 125th anniversary thing has focused everybody on the positives and the fact that the club has been around for 125 years. Yeah. You know, it's only ourselves and Boaz, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, who's the club is, you know, over a century years, which is absolutely stunning and incredible, and it shows you the adversity of both football clubs and the difficult times they've come through. I mean, how many world wars is that? There's probably the two and a couple of other little things, and you know, a couple of civil wars and whatever it might be. But
in between.
Yeah, so I think that's important as well.
And if you look at the likes of Bowes over there, they've obviously had a key strategy behind the scenes over the last couple of years. And you look at them now and they're a completely different club to where they were 5 years ago.
Yeah.
That can be something that Shells can look at. And I know they have a good financial backer, but that doesn't mean they have to go out and spend mad money again.
No,
it just means that they can find a steady strategy that they can build on.
Completely. And to give Boaz their credit, they have, you know, they haven't spent money, you know, in the 5 years. What they've done is they've culturally transitioned the football club through a lot of hard work, through volunteerism. And I hope, tip my hat to them, I have to say. I might get a bit of stick off Shells fans for that, but sure, that's fucking do. That's the way it goes. But I certainly think there are things there that you can use with Boaz. I mean, obviously, Boaz is Boaz, Shells are Shells, and Shells will do their own thing. You know, different things may work for different clubs, but certainly that's the way forward, and you know, that's the you don't have to try your money at things to achieve certain things.
Well, it's going to be great to have that rivalry back as well.
Brilliant. Oh yeah, best. I mean, the Shelds and Bowes derbies that I played in were just incredible. Probably the greatest memory I have in the game is we played Bowes and Dalyman Park. It was a bit of a game decider, and we were both in the same tunnel, because that was probably they brought us through to the same tunnel. It was live on television, and you know, when you're in the Bowes tunnel now, well, all you see ahead of you is the far side. I think it's the Connacht end, and it's always empty because it's dilapidated. The greatest memory I have is actually seeing that full of Shell supporters. I couldn't believe there must have been about 4,000, you know, 3,000-4,000 Shell supporters in that stand alone. In brilliant, great game, a game that we won, which is great. But the memory of standing there looking through that tunnel and seeing that packed Daly Mount, you know, you can't beat memories like that.
Well, speaking of Daly Mount, there's also been good developments over the last week that Daly Mount is going to receive a big chunk of money from the government to try and develop that new stadium. It's going to be shared between Shells and Bowes going forward. It's not going to be done next year or the year after, but that's going to be a massive thing to develop football in that particular area, and also help these clubs find some sort of, you know, just a base that they can be proud of again. Because the likes of Tolka Park, it's old but it's run down. Yeah. Same in Daly Mount Park. If they have this hub that's going to be a brilliant new stadium, then it's something they can build on going forward as well.
And it's a model. It's a model for other clubs to repeat. Like, you know, when I spoke to you about setting standards in football for others to emulate, this is the same thing. Like, you know, touch wood, it gets a bit of traction. Like, you know, I think it's hit a bit of a stumbling block. It's kind of sort of festering in no man's land for the last probably couple of years now, and it really needs an owner to grab a hold of it and say, let's get this going, let's move it forward. I think the positives are that it seems from what I know anyway, it's detached from the FAI nonsense that's going on, and it's very much Dublin City Council, the government and the two clubs. So if they can get that over the line, it'll be fantastic. And it'll be a very good representation of how a good football model can work, bringing in a community. I mean, the plans look fantastic, they look brilliant. So hopefully that is something that they can push on quite quickly.
Yeah, well, between that and Tala, it'll make Dublin the key home for football in Ireland, because the rest of the stadiums in the League of Ireland are really, really poor. And it's something that really needs to be developed for the league to develop as well. Stewie, thanks very much.
No problem, Enda. Cheers.
Now that's our lot for Team 33 for another week. Thanks very much for listening. Remember, you can listen back to any of that show on offtheball.com. Just look up Team 33, or you can get it on any of your podcast apps. We're on Spotify, and we're also on iTunes as well. You can also watch back that segment of myself, Kieran Bradley and Colin Buig running through our favourite rivalries. Hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in next week for some more football chat. Take it away, Johan. We'll be right back.